Hey everyone, welcome to episode 46 of the Historic Performance Podcast. Before getting to today's podcast, I have an announcement to make. This Monday, I'm going to be recording a special episode with three individuals. It's going to be the first time that three people are going to be in a podcast episode. They're going to be Dave Tenney, Chad Kolarczyk, and Ravi, all from the Seattle Sounders Sports Science Department. They're gracious enough to accept my invitation. If you have any questions for them, you know, reach out to me via Twitter at historicperform or shoot me an email, historicperformance@gmail.com. They're going to be more than willing to answer any questions that you have about their high performance program over at the Seattle Sounders who play in Major League Soccer. For today's episode, I'm talking with Ryan Horn. He's the director of performance for men's basketball at Wake Forest University. I was introduced to him by Adam Ringler, who was previously on the podcast a couple weeks ago, who is the high performance coordinator at Wichita State University. I've really been trying to highlight some of the fantastic work that's being done here in the United States at NCAA Division I colleges, especially now that there's been an influx of ideas from throughout the world, especially creating high performance programs within a university setting. Ryan talks about some of the wearable technology that they use at Wake Forest, how they go about creating an athlete-centric training program, both in the in-season and off-season, and just the importance of actually creating player relationships and not just relying on the data. With all that being said, let's get started. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. Today I'm joined by Ryan Horn from Wake Forest University. Ryan, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure, Ryan. A few weeks ago I had Adam Ringler from Wichita State on, and he talked very highly about you and suggested that I bring you on as a guest. So I respect Adam greatly, and I definitely knew I need to have you on.
Well, I appreciate the kind words and support from Adam. He's a great coach in the field right now and continues to push the envelope, and he's definitely heading in the right direction with this program. So that means a lot to me that my colleagues are speaking highly of what we do.
Ryan, could you start us off by just telling us a little bit about yourself and your strength and conditioning journey?
Yeah, I mean, actually for me, it started way back in high school. You know, my brother was a bodybuilder, so I was kind of around the strength training kind of culture and atmosphere the majority of kind of my pre-adolescent, adolescent life. So I kind of caught that bug early. When I got into high school is really when I started to train and start to compete in sports and take more pride in how I was developing myself as an athlete, both in the weight room, on the track, and on the field. So from that point on, it was kind of funny. You know, I read all the Flex magazines and the Muscle and Fitness, and Complete Conditioning for Football was basically the Husker way. It's Nebraska Cornhuskers. They wrote a book in late 90s, early 2000s, and that became my Bible, so to speak. So I was kind of reading that, formulating my own programs, helping my friends out with training. So my coaching and my ability to kind of program for others, you know, started, you know, way before I got the title. So I think that was something for me that was very influential long term, because it kind of gave me a base level of knowledge just in regards of finding information, digging that information out, and then trying it on myself and then trying it on others. Continue to kind of develop and train throughout high school. Was lucky enough to get to go to college to play football. That didn't necessarily turn out how I liked it to. I became much better at preparing and training for the sport than I actually was on the field, and dealt with some injuries. So it left me in a position after my junior year to kind of figure out what I wanted to do. Ended up going back home to finish my college degree, to be with my now wife, which is also kind of my middle school sweetheart. So we've been together for a long time. Went back. Actually, the program I was at didn't have a strength conditioning coach at the college I was at. So really, I had to kind of go out and find kind of my own opportunities and where to go for information, coaches to reach out to. So when that time came, I sent out a ton of emails, ton of phone calls, with little to no success. Luckily, Todd Hammer gave me an opportunity to go to a clinic. He's now at Robert Morris, but gave me an opportunity to go to a clinic. I met Todd there. He ended up offering me an internship, which was fantastic, and gave me a kind of my first step in the profession. And then from that, I actually got my graduate assistant position at VCU from Tim Kontos, who later hired me full time. And I was there for majority of the start of my career for about 5 years. So as far as my road is concerned, as my start in strength conditioning, it's been kind of an unorthodox start. I didn't have a lot of the typical background as far as experience and internships and things like that that are concerned. So yeah, but I think my, definitely thankful for the road that I traveled, because it led me to where I'm at today. So yeah.
Where you're at, you're currently the director of athletic performance for Wake Forest men's basketball team. So you just work with men's basketball?
Yes.
So when you arrived at Wake Forest, what did the men's basketball SNC or high performance program look then? And how has it evolved as over the years or over the time frame that you've been in the position?
Yeah, so a little bit of background. I actually was at University of Tulsa with Coach Manning before I came here. So I've spent, the last 4 years with Coach Manning, so we have a fantastic relationship, and that's a big piece of coming to Wake Forest and wanting to continue to work with him. He's definitely someone that mentors me and that I look up to, that really supports what I do in our program, and that's very important moving forward. No matter where you're at and what you're doing, you have to have a head coach that really buys in to your vision and buys in to the culture of performance and how it can be incorporated into his program and with his team. So when we came to Wake Forest, we're starting our third off season. So we basically went through two full seasons with the program and with the team. When we first arrived, the training style, the technology being used, just the overall culture and expectation in the weight room couldn't be on two further ends of the spectrum. They had a really kind of different training style from what we are accustomed to and what we like to use with our athletes. So from that time frame and that first year, it was really on a daily basis kind of teaching our athletes how to train, what our expectations were, what our standards were, how we wanted them to conduct themselves, how did we want them to prepare, all the little things that can kind of go unnoticed and be taken for granted for early, but that's kind of the foundation moving forward. So a lot of that first year was really just getting our athletes more acclimated to what we were doing, but also in the same time, really developing some good relationships with the players, really educating them on what we are trying to accomplish and how that could affect them and help them perform at a higher level on a daily basis. So from that standpoint, we come in, the staffing before the previous coach that was here was working with men's and women's basketball. Myself, I only work with the men. So having somebody that was completely devoted to them and really locked in, so to speak, to their training and to their progress was different. So from that standpoint, it was a little bit of a transition just from time spent. From a supplementation, intervention strategies, sports science perspective, resources, facilities, those things have extremely, really, the landscape has changed tremendously as far as what we're doing from a sports science perspective, but also new weight room and some other things that we're doing to really try to put ourselves at the forefront of performance, not only in the ACC, but in the country as far as college basketball is concerned. So from that standpoint, I mean, it's really night and day. as far as where we're at now and where we were when we first arrived just over 2 years ago.
Well, sports science in general, when it comes to men's basketball, has really expanded and come to the forefront. But where I want to begin with is actually during the first year, because listening to other podcasts that you've been on, I know that you very much harp on being very good at the basics.
Yes.
And also being athlete based. Mm-hmm. So not you, as you mentioned, that some programs, they go out and they create programs based on position, but you guys actually create programs based on the athlete.
Exactly. So, yeah, I think we have a very, you know, athlete centric model. And what that kind of means for us is that, you know, the positional requirements, while they're extremely important, you know, basketball is a sport where we spend over 90% of our year either practicing or competing in the game of basketball. So from a skill perspective, these athletes, you know, total volume of just skill work is extremely high. But usually their level of general preparation is usually extremely low. So that pyramid has kind of been flipped upside down. But what I found, just from a positional requirement, there's a lot of things that go into, you know, what you need out of certain positions based on your system. So with our team, you know, our guards are extremely versatile. Our bigs have to be extremely versatile. But for me, I have guards that are 5'11". I have guards that are 6'6". So there's a big range in between. So just to train my athletes just based off positional requirements and, you know, basically a long-term athletic development model, in my opinion, isn't going to be the most effective way to train them. What's important for me is creating a specific athlete profile, you know, based off testing, you know, anthropometrics, any type of biomotor or bioenergetic testing, injury screening, their overall readiness, sleep habits, personality. There's a lot of things that go into kind of, you know, really putting and orchestrating that program and that process. So for me, I start with the athlete and understanding that not, you know, one athlete isn't going to respond the same way to the given protocol as another one of our athletes are going to. So for me, it's important to understand those two factors and knowing that, you know, five sets of five for one guy and five sets of five for the other guy can be two totally different results. So from my perspective, it's important for us to look at it as, here's the athlete, here's our program. It's specific to that individual, but also, too, it doesn't really distract from overall what we're trying to accomplish as far as, you know, environment, culture, and things of that nature. And I think it also allows our athletes to really buy into what we're doing, because we're able to maximize each individual and explain that to them in a way where they can see, you know, their program is really truly designed for them with a big picture in mind. So I think for us, it's extremely important that we have a great testing protocol, you know, as far as our battery of testing is concerned, and we really go through and track long-term how these athletes are developing and then continue to fill the gaps as the training process goes on.
Could you actually go into further detail in terms of how you create an athlete profile at Wake Forest?
Yeah, so I mean, it really starts as soon as the athlete steps on campus. So as soon as the athlete steps on campus, the first stop is going to be with our sports medicine team. And our sports medicine team is going to basically look at a variety of evaluations, both from a physical standpoint and also both from a medical standpoint. So they're going to go through a cardiac screening. No athlete's allowed to participate until they've gone through a full cardiac screening battery, just to look at the overall health and make sure that athlete is fit kind of to report for duty, so to speak. They go through that. They're going to go through a basic injury history. They're going to get sickle cell testing. They're also going to look, their vitamin D is also going to be looked at. That's one test that we kind of look at just based on the population and the sport that we're working with. So from that standpoint, they're going to go through that. Then our director of corrective exercise, which is actually, he's actually a physical therapist. He's going to take our athletes through a functional movement screen. Our staff is also involved on that. And we've also used Fugenetics in the past. So basically just an injury screen, just to look at the base level, range of motion wise, where is the athlete at, and just check basic movement efficiency from a general perspective. Once they clear kind of all those batteries and they've been cleared by the medical staff, they're kind of handed off to us, and then we can start doing some of our testing batteries. So when we start, we'll use the intermittent recovery tests, which is going to be basically the beep test, to look at just basic all what their aerobic or what their fitness capabilities are as soon as they step on campus. Athletes will perform a 10 and a 20 meter sprint just to look at acceleration and speed. We're going to do body composition, body weights, obviously, profile pictures, and then we'll do some, from there, we're going to do some more movement-based testing. So we'll do a threefold jump, a standing vertical, an approach vertical. We're also going to be performing a modified lane agility test that's used in the NBA combine. And then really the strength testing and things of that nature aren't really going to be performed yet because we just don't know how they move and how they look. So a lot of the base testing are things we can look at with minimal risk or minimal cost without knowing a whole bunch about the athlete. Then we're also going to do some basic omega wave readiness testing just to kind of look at the system and what that athlete's baseline is when they step on campus. So from that profile, we can really look at some different bioenergetic and biomotor components and kind of start to fill the gaps from there.
Once you've created the athlete profile and they've gone through all these battery of tests, they've been cleared by the sports medicine department, looked at in terms of the FMS by the director of correctives, how do you go about individualizing training for each specific athlete? And what are some of the challenges that surround that?
Yeah, I think what you look at early on is understanding that there's a lot of moving pieces. We have athletes that have been here for extended period of time, and they have one training protocol, one training program. Then you also have your new guys coming in, which they can be freshmen, they can be a fifth year graduate student, or they can be a transfer. So that's a pretty, you know, eclectic group of people with different ranges of experience. So for the young guys, when they come in, and once we have that basic profile, a lot of guys are going to go through a very similar introductory period in that first summer session. So a little bit of how our year is kind of broken up. Most of our freshmen and transfers will report usually the first or second week of June, and they will start summer school. That'll be their first kind of introduction to our program when they train. The previous returning guys, they'll actually have been on campus since the end of May, so they already have a couple weeks into the program. So when we get those new guys in, typically it's a 4 to 6 week block of training that's not only going to get these athletes prepared, but really at that point, they're training just to be able to train. So it's a basic GPP block. We're going to take guys through a variety of movements, both from a teaching perspective, but a high volume of work, relative strength-wise, body weight, because this 4 to 6 week block is also a screen and an evaluation tool as well, just to see how they respond to different varying levels of volume, intensity, how do they acclimate themselves to the environment, are they a productive member of the team, and then in that block, guys can be pulled and put into different programs. For instance, if we have an older guy or a transfer or a post-grad, he might not stay in that block for an extended period of time, just based off his general, just based on his general preparation of where he's at, so he can slide out of that. But overall, we want our athletes to go through that phase just so they can learn how we do things, so we can evaluate their technique, we can evaluate their fitness, we can evaluate their strength, and our staff can be heavily involved. So in that, whether like this summer, it's going to be six guys. So in that six guy group, we are purely focusing on those guys. They train at a different time, and then we can kind of coordinate our programs based off that. But it's very fluid. It's very dynamic. We have some baseline goals that we want to accomplish in that block just from a attitude and a habit perspective as far as how they approach the training, how do they approach the recovery and things of that nature, and then we can kind of incorporate them in. So from that standpoint, that extended period is still an evaluation and a measurement tool for us. Our other guys, the testing has been frequent. So as we test postseason, we test preseason, you know, we're testing pre and post summer as well. As we see those metrics or those numbers start to improve and start to change, then we can start to fill the gaps with some of the things that we're doing. So based off, and I haven't mentioned this before, but also based off some of our force plate scans as well, we can start to really look at the program and see what this specific athlete needs, whether it's an issue with training age and maximal strength development, or if it's a thing where they have an appreciable amount of maximal strength, and then we need to kind of work on some different methods to kind of fill the gaps for some of our older athletes that have been in our program that can use some more advanced methods. But yes, for us, you know, I still believe that we have to consistently master the basics and then apply those fundamentals on a daily basis to kind of get some long-term adaptation and gain. So I think it's a very large question in a sense, just based off which athlete we're working with.
No, definitely. And you did mention force plates, which actually brings me to a question that one of the listeners had recommended I ask you. And his question was, what specific force plate tests do you run and how frequently? And also, do you use the force plate at all when it comes back to assessing return to play for the basketball players?
Yeah, so the force plate for us, we were in a position that one of our donors was very interested in the Sparta Science system and what Sparta was doing with some different programs all over the country. And he actually came to us and we discussed that. And that was something that we felt could be extremely beneficial, not only for our staff, but also for our athletes as well. So we went forward with acquiring the Sparta Science technology. We use one force plate, it's a Kistler plate. I know there's a lot of discussion on Twitter and social media about the use of, you know, bilateral plates and different software and applications you can use. I have minimal experience in a lab. I'm not a researcher. I'm not a sports scientist. I'm a coach at heart. And our technology needs to be something that makes sense in our workflow and needs to give us information that we can use to drive our decision making. And it needs to be something that's extremely, I wouldn't say easy to operate, but efficient within our staff and within our group. So Sparta really filled and checked a lot of those boxes for us, and it's been a good piece. We've been using it since November of last year. So basically how we use the plate and the test that we are going to use, our first jump scan is just going to basically be a vertical jump test. It's going to be six jumps performed, reset, jump, six total jumps on the plate, and then the guys are going to run through that test. Unless they have an injury or anything that prevents them from doing it, that's going to be our baseline scan. It's going to give us things in regards, if you're not familiar with the Sparta technology, but they're going to utilize their database to kind of look at an athlete's load, which is going to be their eccentric rate of force development, their explode, which is going to be their ability to reverse and then basically jump off the plate, and then their drive, which is going to be their ability to sustain force into the plate and carry it through, so to speak. So when we look at those load and explode and drive factors, we can kind of have a good idea of what some of the injury potential is for our athletes based on that profile, but also what we need to incorporate or maybe take out of our program to help them to continue to develop. Because we have a lot of guys that can jump extremely high, but the issue becomes mechanically, how are they expressing those forces? And that's going to give us some more information on both their injury potential, but also what they need to do from a programming perspective. We're also going to do a sway balance test, which is basically the athlete has basically puts on a blindfold or a sleep mask. He's going to balance on one foot, and it's a 20-second test. He rolls through, does three repetitions each side, and that's going to kind of the test is done barefooted. That's a test that we do kind of quarterly just to look at overall balance. If it's a situation with return to play, which I'll get to in a second. I can give you a specific example, then we can use that test as a substitute for a basic jump scan. So from that standpoint, we'll look and see how does the athlete balance, how does he stabilize, and then we can look at some of those things from a programming perspective if there is an imbalance or a big difference between limbs. The third test that we're going to use on the force plate is basically a single leg landing test. The athlete's about 3 feet from the plate. He's barefoot again, just like the balance test. He's going to jump onto the plate. So if he's jumping off his right foot, he'll land on his left foot. And the test is going to basically measure not only how much force is the athlete putting into the plate when they land, but how quickly they can stabilize that limb. So from that standpoint, that's a fantastic test for us to really look at. You can't cheat that test. So we can really look at, you know, is there any issue between sides? If it's a return to play, is there a confidence issue? Is there a psychological issue with putting pressure and force into that leg? Are they landing softer on one side or can they not stabilize? And then from that standpoint, we can look and see if there's any type of imbalance or limb discrepancy based off that test. And then we also do a upper body sway analysis, which is basically going to be an athlete's going to be in a push-up position with one hand on the plate. He'll lift the opposite hand up, and he's going to basically stabilize himself on the plate. And that also gives us a good feedback of just upper body symmetry as well. And basketball, obviously, is not as much of a upper body component as far as our injuries are concerned, but it gives us some good information to kind of get a baseline of test. So that's going to be the test that we perform on the plate. As far as a return to play situation, we kind of flip-flop it. So, for instance, we had an athlete that had a foot injury this season, and we were able to kind of use the force plate as a part of his return to play process. And the first test we started off with was the balance test. We looked at his balance to make sure his symmetry was good, and that was after he's cleared. And then once the athlete passes the balance test, he can progress to the single leg landing. Once we progress and we can pass the single leg landing, then we can move on to the 2 foot jump or the basic jump scan. So that's kind of our return to play process there. We're also doing that weekly to see as we increase that athlete's volume in the return to play process, whether it be on the court, with running, cutting, practice duration, etc., we can also see how do they respond. Are we seeing changes in the test? Are we seeing fatigue? Is the foot or the injured area still debilitating in a sense? And then how is he progressing and responding and adapting to those volumes? So for us, I think it's been a big tool, not only for our staff, but also to connect ourselves with sports medicine and give us a platform from which we can discuss some of our athletes' basic progress from a general perspective, but also some of our return to play protocols. Then we can also connect some of that information with what we're doing from an athlete tracking perspective to give us a pretty clear picture on where we're at and how the athlete is performing.
We started off discussing the importance of the basics, but you also mentioned how sports science department and some of the wearable technologies that you use at Wake Forest has been evolving since that first initial year. During the in-season basketball schedule here in terms, it's pretty condensed. And as you mentioned, your guys are going about 90% of the year, you're training, and practicing. So in-season, how do you go about monitoring players to make sure that they're quote unquote fresh for the game and that you're effectively managing fatigue?
Yeah, I don't know how many college basketball players are actually completely fresh for any game.
Yeah, that's what I put quote unquote.
I don't know how many you're going to get that are operating at 100%. If I speak to a coach and he tells me his athletes feel 100% all the time, either they're not training hard enough or they're not actually competing. So I have a hard time believing we're going to be completely fresh. But when we look at it, I think you have to start you can kind of put yourself in a trap if you kind of just view yourself as a fatigue manager. I think it really starts with how you prepare your athletes, in the sense that when we look back and we're trying to look at how our athletes are progressing and how they're developing, it starts with how we prepare them. And I think it's extremely hard to protect someone or protect something that you didn't prepare appropriately. So I think it really all starts with knowing the demands of the game, but also knowing the demands of what your actual head coach is going to put them through. You can talk to 10 different basketball programs and you get 10 different answers on how their coaches operate practice. How long do they like to practice? Where do they like their days off? What type of drills do they like to do in their practice sessions? All of those things are going to factor in to how we prepare our guys. So in the summertime, if you really look at what we're doing, we get a good 10 to 12 week window where we can actually develop and really train our guys. And what I mean by that is it's not a complementary approach, because the athletes only have 2 hours of individuals during the summer. So they're basically getting 2 or 1 hour exposures with the support or with the coaching staff per week. So during that time, it's really the only time of year where they're taking a minimal course load. They usually have 1 or 2 classes that they're taking. We're able to really look at how they're fueling, how they're eating, how they're training, and we can control a lot of those variables during that summer block of training. So from that standpoint, that's the time of the year where we're going to apply the most stress to our athletes from a general perspective, to help develop their strength, to help develop their resiliency, to add muscle tissue, to increase speed, power, etc., all the things that we like doing as coaches. That's going to be the base and the foundation for how the athletes respond and how they continue to perform throughout the year. With basketball season running from basically September all the way till April, you can't really tell me there's an off-season and in-season period. Once you get into that in-season period, if you immediately slam the brakes and start going to a maintenance model, which I don't really necessarily still understand what maintenance training means. I'm still kind of dumbfounded by that. But we need to continue to develop these kids throughout the season, and especially during out-of-conference play, to make sure that we continue to develop maximal strength, to continue to train in the weight room, and to ride that wave as long as we can. And then as we get towards the tail end of the season, then we can start to taper some volume and then ride it through into the conference tournament and then the postseason play. So what we really look at in season is kind of understanding, you know, minutes played, the demand of the game, some of our sport view tracking, you know, that we're using in our arena and in our practice facility. We're able to look at top speeds, the distance the athletes are covering, how many minutes they're playing, and have a good idea on game load. The guys that play the most are usually the most fatigued. I mean, it's not earth-shattering news, but, you know, I mean, I think everybody tries to make it really sexy, and this guy's demands this. It's real simple. If you play a lot, you're going to be fatigued, and we have to manage that. You combine that with really quick turnarounds, with having anywhere between 2 to upwards of 4 games in a week, then you have yourself a recipe for disaster. So the periodization model, how you train, has to be extremely fluid, but you have to continue to develop these athletes throughout the season. So when we get done with the summer and we come into preseason, that's a block that we're going to be in. Our coach likes to run a preseason boot camp, so to speak. It's kind of a tradition. So in that 6-week block of preseason, we're really making sure that our guys are usually in shape. That's usually not an issue just because we're playing through so much throughout the year. What I usually find is our guys need more maximal strength and power development throughout the year. Usually from a fitness perspective, unless we have an athlete that has some specific needs or some issues to work with, our conditioning really never becomes a factor just because of the amount that we're playing. I mean, guys in American football aren't getting up and go play pickup football full contact, but my guys are playing basketball every single single day. So from that standpoint, from a skill and a fitness perspective, we do a pretty decent job of keeping those capabilities and keeping those qualities throughout the year. So when we get in that preseason period and the volume's a little bit higher and coaches are putting them through their paces, we will adjust some things from a strength training standpoint to pick some exercises that are a little bit less structurally taxing. But once that initial preseason block kind of ends and then we get into the regular season, I like to kind of use a wave, so to speak, with our guys. We're able to kind of continue to stay in that 75% to 85% range while also using some velocity-based training protocols, but can continue to train at a high level as far as how we approach it. We're still squatting, we're still benching, we're still doing the Olympic lifts. We're adjusting the volume and the intensity on a daily basis based on how that athlete feels and how they're recovering. But we can kind of ride that wave all the way until we really start conference training. And then once we get into the conference season, we start to taper some of that volume down, take away some of the more structurally taxing lifts, and then progress them into the conference. So it's kind of like this crescendo in intensity, so to speak. And then we're going to kind of be able to pull that volume down as we continue to taper and the nature of the season starts to set in. But really, back to your initial question, I think it really starts with how you prepare the athletes. And then that's going to determine how they perform. And then the things that we're doing from a tracking sports science piece and relationship piece, that's how we protect them during the year. So it's really perform or prepare, perform, protect. And that's kind of like our three-prong deal that we educate our staff on and what we're trying to do. So once we get into the season, I think the technology piece should help you, but it shouldn't hinder you. And it also shouldn't be a thing where you immediately get in the season, you're like, oh, well, we're playing basketball, I got to pull back. And next thing you know, we're doing a lot of therapeutic and corrective exercise. That's another term that I don't really understand necessarily, because all exercises should be corrective. But I digress. But as we move on through that, your guys got to train and they got to develop and they have to have a good base of maximal strength. They have to have a good base of lean muscle mass, and they have to have the nutritional and recovery habits to really be a pro on a daily basis during the year. But a lot of that foundation work is set in the off season. Then you must continue to stoke that fire throughout the year and be diligent and be responsible with it as far as what you're doing to make sure it doesn't detract or hinder performance on game day. But the loading and the periodization and things of that nature become very dynamic during the year. So the way we look at it is that we have two main training sessions per week. One session is going to be a little bit more strength dominant with a little bit more time under tension. So therefore, we have a little bit of more of a soreness factor, but we can manage that quite effectively. And then the second session, which is usually closest to the game, a la like a Dan Baker, is going to be more speed, strength, and power dominant to really spike our guys. And that's a similar template that we're going to use later on in the year. In the beginning of the year, we'll have some more of those strength dominant sessions and a little bit more time under tension with our assistance work, with a little bit more structurally taxing exercises earlier on in the year. And we'll continue to phase and progress those exercises out. So from a training perspective, that's how it has to operate. Then the number of days you're training, the type of exercises you're using, loading parameters, things of that nature are all going to be dependent on how much do you play. Are you riding the bench? Are you redshirt? Are you transferred? Do you have to sit out? Then you're going to train more. You're going to continue to develop. When you don't play on game day, you're going to have to do conditioning and fitness work on that day to make sure you're keeping up with the rest of the squad, so to speak. And then the guys that are at your upper end, they're going to be your high rotation guys that are playing 30 minutes a game. Those are guys you have to really look at and manage appropriately. But from a training perspective, that's kind of how I look at it. So in season, you know, one thing for me, full range of motion movements, squatting, pressing, benching, the Olympic lifts. You know, for instance, example might be that we would be cleaning, doing some hand cleans and power cleans from the floor during early part of the year, and then progress out to doing some hang cleans and then some, obviously, some clean pulls. So that's an example of a simple progression where we don't really have to change the exercise, so to speak, to eliminate some of the stiffness and soreness qualities, but we can just modify how it's being performed to make it a little bit less structurally really taxing when the really the demand of the season starts to kind of set in. So that's kind of how we view the weight room perspective. Does that kind of answer your question?
No, it definitely does. You mentioned velocity-based training. So how do you utilize VBT with some of your players?
I think when you really go back to it and we're looking in the weight room and we're looking for all these different pieces, both on the court and the weight room and the things we're trying to use, the technology or the sports science that you're using has to make sense for your program. It has to be something that you can replicate on a daily basis and be consistent with you. Then it has to give you feedback that helps drive some of your decision-making process. So for us, you know, VBT was something that we started using. I'd used Tendo's in the past. We transitioned to using the GymAware unit this past year. So really for us, based off some of Brian Mann's work, someone I highly respect, and I recommend everybody, if you're interested in VBT, you go out and you purchase his materials and read his work. It's fantastic. We use a lot of simple protocols just to look at bar speed and kind of get away from some of the basic percentage loading. So, for example, if we look at percentages for my guys, I have guys that are 6'10". So it's just basic physics. So if he's using 70%, and then we have another athlete that's using 70% that's 6 foot tall, mechanically there's some different things going on within that athlete. So for us, it allows us to use percentages to kind of give a starting point and a guideline, but then to use the velocity-based training protocols to really modify not only volume, but also what specific speed or velocity are we working at and what type of adaptation are we getting. I also find that it helps us really teach the athletes and hold them accountable from the sense that when it's on there, guys move the bar faster. I don't know if there's any studies that have looked at that. I don't think there is, but I know when we pull the iPads out and we put the GymAwares on, our guys have more intent when they lift. They're more mindful of what they're doing. Their weight selection, I do give some of my older guys some freedom with loading, so to speak. If they feel good one day or another day, maybe not so much. I do give them some freedom and some wiggle room and some kind of thresholds to work within as far as volume and intensity is concerned. But that's definitely for the reserve for the guys that I have a really good working relationship with and that I trust. But when we look at that, I think it provides you with a much easier way to kind of look at your training on a daily basis and understanding that there's a big difference between readiness and preparedness. You know, in the off season, our preparedness is going to be our ceiling. That's our potential. That's our maximal output of what we can do. In season, we're looking at athletes' readiness and understanding, you know, is he going to be at 70, 80, 90% of where he was? Using percentages, from a bench max, so to speak, that I took in August and then trying to use it in February, there's a lot of things that have happened since that time. And we're not doing any maximal strength testing in season for a majority of the guys. Sometimes we might let them work up and feed the beast a little bit. But overall, those numbers become extremely kind of outdated and not really applicable to what our athletes are working with at that time. So RPEs and using velocity-based training allows us to continue to maximize the athlete's productivity on a daily basis while understanding that his readiness is going to shift, you know, kind of up and down that ladder, so to speak, depending on the demands of the game and where he's at, time of day, when the workout is, how he's feeling, what type of injury history or pathology that he's experiencing during the year. All those things are going to factor into our loading. So with the velocity-based training, that's how we're going to use it. As far as the specific kind of thresholds and velocity, so to speak, I mean, that's going to be kind of determined on the individual, what their technique is. What we find with guys that aren't as experienced and aren't as technically proficient, their velocities bounce around a little bit because every rep's a little bit different. So they're not as experienced with how they're moving the bar. But overall, that gives us a good framework and a good starting point from which to work off with how we're going to adjust our sets. So for instance, for our guys, if they were working on, you know, let's say we're utilizing a squat movement and we're looking at, you know, our average velocity being 0.75 meters per second, and we're working at that specific speed, we're going to have our athlete warm up. Once he hits that specific speed within that range of 0.75 to 0.8, he's going to perform his sets. The reps are going to be determined on the time of year and what we're trying to accomplish. But that's a great way to look at, here's the speed, see how long that athlete can continue to hit those speeds. And then when the speed drops off and we're out of that quality and speed starts to slow, well, then we can, you know, the cessation of the set can stop and then we can move on to the next exercise. But that's also a kind of catch 22 because our athletes aren't stupid and they can kind of figure that out. So depending on the guy and who you have to have a certain relationship to understand that some of the guys are smart enough to figure out that if I don't put maximal force into this bar and my speed drops down, then I'm done. So a guy might be having a bad day. He might be in a situation where, you know, he might not be feeling it. So you can navigate that. So there is some of that that you have to work with. So more for me and the coaching staff that I have and using more coaches, I think we're able to give some guidelines, give some thresholds, you know, with the gym aware, you're able to use the cloud-based function where you can do some prescribed sets and thresholds before the session. So we're able to kind of get that in the iPad right from the beginning and understand that that athlete's program is loaded and ready to roll. And then you can kind of look at it from that standpoint. So it's a very set-by-set basis in seeing how the guys train and seeing what they're doing. But I think it does give us a tool, especially in season, that allows us to continue to train and use those movements for a longer period of time, just because we do have a little bit more information for which to work off of.
Ryan, one of the reasons I was cracking up over here is because I think you really hit the nail on the head when it comes to a lot of people talk about wearable technology and subjective monitoring, and they just look at it from a perspective of numbers. But I think many times they forget that there's a coaching relationship aspect to
exactly
to managing athletes.
Exactly. And I think you put it right there, because if I say right now, what's 750 mean to you? You're going to say, well, it's 750. If I tell you that that was our player load for yesterday's practice, you're going to be like, okay, well, 750 is a number. All right, cool. 750, that's the player load. If I tell you that their player load per minute with the catapult tracking was, you know, let's say it's 9.8 per minute. You say, okay, well, is that hard or is that easy? Well, it depends on the athlete and depends on the amount of information, how rich that data set is. We're on our third year of tracking right now, okay? The first year, I didn't really speak on it that much because I didn't even know what was going on. And I still really, in the first year, you know, we track and we haven't really talked about it yet. Yeah. But really, you know, with Catapult, we started off actually with GP Sports in the first year. And using some technology, we got it and started hooking the guys up in that summer period. And I didn't really know what any of the information meant. I mean, we were tracking it. Is 150 high? I don't know. We'll see. So you're kind of playing this very fluid and dynamic game of getting this information, speaking with the athlete, having a great discussion, seeing how he's performing, and then moving on from there. So our first year, we were very careful with what we spoke about with our coaches, what we shared with our medical staff and with our coaching staff, just because our knowledge base and our competency of really looking at the data and making informed decisions. Anybody that says you can plug it in, push play, and next thing you know, you're you know, Bill Nye, the science guy, I don't think that necessarily follows suit, because you haven't been able to accumulate enough data over time to really look at each individual athlete and start to say, okay, here's some different things that we're looking at. Here's a typical session for this athlete. You know, here's where he's above and below the standard, so to speak, of where he's at. So that first year, we just accumulated data and we looked at it, and it was a little bit more reactive in the sense of just seeing, okay, here's this session. How do the athlete feel? What do the numbers look like? You know, what did some of our wellness questionnaires look like? What's the discussion from the coaches? How do they think the guys looked? How do the players feel? You know, we did a little bit more omega wave testing in the first year. You know, how did that respond? And then even with the omega wave testing, some guys are just yellow. They, you know, it's really looking at with their readiness. Some guys just have a certain level that they're at, and you're working off that. Not everybody's going to hit the same number or the same amount. So what you have to look at is consistency over time of tracking as much as possible and getting as much information as possible. So that first year we went back, we were able to look at some drills. And what I like to do in our sessions is basically tag all of our activities and our periods. And I can look at each individual drill so to speak, off our script and have a good idea of where those thresholds are. So for instance, if we're running a shell drill, which is a pretty intense half court defensive drill, that's one of our red level drills. So when I give coach his basically pool of exercises or his exercise menu, that's a red level drill because it has a higher level of intensity, because it has a higher level of player load per minute. So we know that's an intense drill that's taxing. Then we can work down into yellow, into green, and my head coach loves colors. So that's what I'm going to show him. And that's his drill database. But I'm very careful in that first year to understand, let's accumulate information. Let's see what the numbers look like. And then the second year, now we're becoming a little bit more comfortable. We have a drill database from which we can work on. We have a year of data that kind of gives us the baseline. And then in the second year, we continue to track. We continue to look at some things. We're able to look at our weekly periodization schedule as far as what type of player load averages we want to hit per session, as far as how far out we're from a game. And how, you know, in looking at T minus 2 days, 1 day, and how close we are. And now we can do a little bit more proactive work with programming our practice schedule a little bit more efficiently and effectively. And then still, I mean, you still have to look at it as stuff happens. So if a guy, if the team's not ready for practice, or there's an emotional piece to that as well. So while the numbers kind of drive, you know, and give us a framework to work off of, I'm not saying, coach, this is exactly what you should do. These are the drills you should do. This is how I would do it, and blah, 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 because I'm not the expert. He's the head coach. He's the basketball coach. From a skill perspective, he is the expert, and he's going to make that final decision. My responsibility as the director of athletic performance is to give him thresholds and boundaries from which to work on, and to provide him with meaningful data that helps him make better decisions and helps give him more information from which to work. So after the second year, I think we got a little bit of a handle on it, but I get a little upset and a little irritated that, you know, people are really saying that they're getting all this information right away and it's completely changed their program, which in theory, you really don't have enough information yet. And then once you get that information, do you know what the heck you're doing with it? And do you know how to present it to your staff in a way that makes sense for them, in a way that helps them make decisions? So I think we're on third year of tracking. Hopefully we're a little bit better this year. I think we're getting a little bit more comfortable. Our staff's a little bit more receptive of it. We've had some return to play things we've used the catapult data for that's been beneficial for our athletes and beneficial for our sports medicine staff. And our culture and the people we have in our program or more receptive of it. And that's where the magic's going to happen. If our culture isn't right and the people aren't receptive of it and the head coach doesn't want it, nor does he respect it, it's just something that he's doing because everybody else is doing, you know, you can't stand because you don't have any legs. So it's important for me to understand when we got here, and I know you've said you've watched some other podcasts, you know, we had an athlete playing pickup when we were at the University of Tulsa that basically collapsed and died on the court, and they had to revive him. It was an unsupervised game of pickup. He had a genetic defect in his heart. They were luckily able to resuscitate him, and he's went on and has a fantastic life. But from that point, our head coach is like, what can we do to make sure that this never happens again? And what can we do to really protect the well-being of our student athletes? And that motivated him. So whether it's winning or losing or a traumatic experience, we need to have something that really motivates our coaches to want to start to implement some of these new ideas, so to speak, because you do have some issues with that. And I was speaking with different coaches about, well, the coach has won 40 games a year, so why the heck does he need this stuff? That doesn't make any sense. But the fact of the matter is we're looking to get a return on our investment. We're looking to increase player availability and make sure you have the players that you need to be successful for the longest period of time possible. But it all starts with the head coach.
No, definitely. And yeah, I listened to that podcast with Jay DeMeo where you mentioned that incident. And it really made me reflect on it, because as strength coaches, we have a lot of responsibility. We really have to make sure that player safety is paramount. And if in the case that there's such an unfortunate incident, that we're prepared to take actions in order to have a good result the way it happened there.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's not about sets and reps or increasing somebody's vertical or running faster or vice versa. I mean, that's about somebody's life. That's somebody's livelihood. That really on a daily basis, that's the kind of pressure that we're under, not just wins and losses or expectations or anything like that. But really, we have these athletes' well-being in our hands. So when I look at our numbers, I look at our testing numbers. You know, we look at player availability over the last 2 years. You know, we've had 730 possible opportunities for our scholarship players to play in basketball games. Our players have been available for over 720 of those opportunities in those 2 years, which is about a 98% availability rate. That's how our coach is going to measure our staff. Are our athletes performing? The training's the easy part. Getting them stronger, getting them faster, all those things, you know, really for us are easy. It's the daily management and making sure that our vision and making sure that we're seeing the big picture and giving our athletes the most resources possible, and not resources like money or supplementation or technology or equipment, but giving them us, our time, our attention, our expertise, you know, making sure we have a relentless approach to find the best ways to develop and train our athletes. And that's our responsibility to them, to protect them. But it all falls back to the vision of the head coach and the support that you're going to get moving forward. So I think that all plays into it.
I think we're already going down this route, but there's a lot of young SNC coaches that listen to this podcast. And I was just hoping, what types of recommendations would you have for them, especially those who are just kind of starting out their career, maybe have done one internship or so?
Yeah, I think one of the things you look at with young guys, and everybody has a different road that they travel to get in this profession and in this career, whether you're male, female, or anything else. I think it really goes back to understanding first, is this something you really want to do? Because I think a lot of people look at guys and gals that are at the top of the profession, so to speak, and have the jobs that everybody either thinks they were lucky enough to get, or they knew somebody, or vice versa, which I think is also funny, that, you know, all the guys at the top are just lucky or they knew somebody. But I couldn't be further from the truth. Everybody has to work to get to the point that they're at. But this day and age, I think we need to really look at, everybody's so accessible. I can go on Twitter right now and I can tweet at Brian Mann about VBT, and within, you know, a couple minutes he can respond back and we have a discussion like that. And then in the past that hasn't happened. So I think young strength conditioning coaches have to, one, get in the weight room, train yourself, experiment with yourself, continue to push yourself from a professional development perspective and get out of your comfort zone. Professional development's no different than training. It should be periodized, but it should make you uncomfortable. It should challenge you. You should leave some sessions or some discussions or conferences or clinics. You should leave feeling frustrated. You should leave feeling inspired, and you should want to continue to push the envelope from a training perspective. But early on, I think coaches have to really maximize the fundamentals and learn the basics, master them, learn how to squat, learn how to move, learn how to train, learn basic periodization and program design, volunteer, intern where you're at, go out, visit other coaches. And I think you have to really look at where do you want to be and go find people that are there and doing the things that you want to do. And once you find that person, use your network, use social media, email, pick up a phone, call them. You know, I love having discussions each week. I talk to multiple coaches on a weekly basis. Just reach out to them. They reach out to me, and we have good, meaningful discussion. It's a good way to bounce off ideas, but it's a great way to share your information and just hear your philosophy and the things that you're doing and start to verbalize them so you can really think if they make sense. And I'm lucky to have a fantastic network of coaches that I associate with on a daily basis, and they keep me honest. If I call them and have this great idea and they're like, it sucks, I'm like, all right, well, maybe I've tried that and I used that, it didn't really work, make this adjustment. So I have to learn from other people's mistake and other people's experiences And that's the way you do it. And that's how you continue to move forward. But also, as someone in my position, as I continue to grow and continue to, you know, be in the profession a little bit longer, I have to pay it forward as well and continue to mentor these kids and make sure they come to us when they intern and have a great intern curriculum. And we expose them to a lot of different things. We teach them the profession, not only how to train athletes, but how to conduct yourself, how to network, you know, how to build relationships with athletes, and all those things kind of go into play. But for instance, this podcast, you know, it's a 40-minute, 60-minute podcast. We were able to cover some general things, but when you listen to these podcasts, there's a lot more specific things that we weren't able to cover. So when we're talking about actual training, you know, we can spend an hour talking about our summer training, you know, whether it's, you know, speed development or strength development or all those different things, we can spend just one podcast doing that. So when you listen to these podcasts, and it's kind of a buffet, so to speak, of concepts and theory and things that a coach is doing, if it inspires you and it piques your interest, then reach out to that coach and continue to dig deeper and get past the different layers of what that coach is actually doing. So I think for young strength coaches, you have to get out there. You have to put yourself out there. Understand that you're not looking to impress anybody when you speak to them. No one cares about anybody that can just regurgitate a bunch of information. They want to know what you've done, what you can do, what your experience is. Yeah, you read, you know, Carl Vallée or did an article on, you know, whatever it may be, flywheel training. And you're speaking on flywheel training, but have you ever did it? No. Well, no one cares what you can regurgitate. Everybody cares of what your experience is and can they learn from that. So I think all those things go into young strength conditioning coaches to make sure they have a great network of people around them to go that route.
Ryan, as you mentioned, you know, here at the podcast, we're trying to cover, kind of give a broad overview of what's going on. But as if anyone has any questions to reach out to, what's the best way that anybody who's listening to this podcast and wants to learn further about what's going on Wake Forest can reach out to you?
My email is hornrl, so that's H-O-R-N-R-L at WFU.edu. Also can feel free to contact me via social media, you know, Twitter, RyanHorn45. Or on Instagram, RyanHorn45. So any of those outlets would be fantastic ways to get in touch with me. If anybody wants to discuss what we're doing or has any specific questions or just wants to talk shop, I'm always open and willing to do so.
And I'm going to make sure to link that in the show notes when I publish it tomorrow. And Ryan, it was a pleasure having you on. Thanks so much for sharing your information. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure the listeners appreciate it as well.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate you having me on. Thanks.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of the Historic Performance Podcast. If you enjoyed it, please make sure to head over to iTunes to leave a review and rating. It really helps others discover the show. As I mentioned, next week I'm going to be recording a special episode with many of the members of the Seattle Sports Science Department. So if you have any questions for them, make sure to reach out to me and I'll include them within the episode. Thanks, and I'll see you guys next week.